Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Today is Monday, December 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter is dead at the age of 100.
I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over.
How will Jimmy Carter's legacy be remembered?
And there would have been no George W. Bush PEPFAR program in Africa for AIDS treatment if there wasn't Jimmy Carter as an ex-president pushing those kinds of interventions as soon as basically he left office.
And a look at how Jimmy Carter's work after the Oval Office impacted Africa. Former U.S. President Carter has died in his hometown of Plains in the southern state of Georgia. We have with us on the line a U.S. political historian who knew former President Carter. Thanks for joining us this morning, Alan Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of Political History at American University in Washington. We're going to talk about Jimmy Carter's legacy, of course, but you knew him. You got to talk with him a number of times. What kind of man was he? Not as a U.S. president necessarily, but the man that you knew.
You know, we hear a lot about evangelical Christians today. Donald Trump claims to represent them. Jimmy Carter was a true evangelical Christian, perhaps the most devout major political leader we've ever had. And it was reflected not in his policies, but in how he lived his life as a moral exemplar and as someone who didn't interpret his religion as us versus them and negative and attacking, but rather in terms of what one could do for humanity, dealing with and helping the needy, the sojourner, the stranger, those who are different from us. And I had an incredibly memorable encounter with Jimmy Carter in 1979 when we both were running the Catoctin Mountain 10-kilometer race just outside the presidential retreat of Camp David. That race became notorious because Jimmy Carter collapsed during the race. Not a huge surprise. It was the toughest race I've ever been in. 5K down and 5K straight up the mountain. But that was the big story. But here's the story I knew personally that no one talked about and that tells you much more about Jimmy Carter, the man. After the race, we have a gathering when they give out awards to those who did well. And guess who showed up with no fanfare, no publicity, no press? Jimmy Carter, after that collapse, and gave us one of the most uplifting spiritual talks I've ever heard. 45 years later, that was still one of the peak experiences of my life, and I will never forget it. And then I worked with Jimmy Carter on the Carter-Baker Commission, and he was as sharp as ever and as dedicated as ever. As President Biden said in his eulogy just this evening, to giving everyone a chance, giving everyone an opportunity.
Right, right. And that's incredible, that story you just told. How will his presidency be remembered?
It'll be mixed. You know, obviously he had the difficulty with what's called stagflation, high inflation, high unemployment, the tragedy of the Iran hostage crisis, and that'll always be, you know, part of his legacy. But, you know, what's often lost is all the positive things he did as president. Established the Department of Energy, moved us towards conservation. Of course, one of the great diplomatic triumphs of our time, the Camp David Accords that made peace between Egypt and Israel, right, starting us down the road of deregulation, the SALT II Treaty, the Panama Canal Treaty. So there is a legacy above and beyond what most people talk about, and that is his extraordinary role as a former president.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying he's going to be mostly remembered for being the elder statesman that he was.
That's correct. You know, establishing the Carter Center, which did so much good around the world, including in Africa. You know, he was involved in monitoring elections, in trying to negotiate conflicts and moving towards peace, in, of course, fighting the scourge of terrible diseases, including the guinea worm epidemic in Africa. We are now, thanks to Jimmy Carter, to a great extent, the guinea worm may be the second major disease after smallpox to be totally eradicated. It just was one of his extraordinary accomplishments. And we talked today about, you know, the housing crisis and rising homelessness. Well, Jimmy Carter was doing something about that through his work in Habitat for Humanity and building houses for the needy. He lived the spiritual life, both as a moral man and as a servant to humanity.
An amazing man indeed. That's Alan Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of History at American University here in Washington, talking with us. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure. Take care.
VOA's Cain Farabaugh extensively covered the former president's life and post-presidential career, promoting global health and democracy, and has more on the legacy of the 39th president of the United States.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear.
When Jimmy Carter took the oath of office on January 20th, 1977, he promised a government as good as its people.
There can be no nobler nor more ambitious task for America to undertake on this day of a new beginning than to help shape a just and peaceful world.
A world he continued to shape beyond his single term in the White House, becoming a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, heading the global nonprofit, the Carter Center, whose mission is waging peace, fighting disease, and building hope.
I look upon the Carter Center work as an extension of what I try to do as president.
Carter was born in Plains, Georgia in 1924. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1946, serving as a submarine officer before returning to Plains in 1953 to run the family farm in the wake of his father's death. Carter entered politics during the civil rights movement of the 1960s, serving two terms as a Georgia legislator before becoming the state's governor in 1971.
I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over.
Carter went from being an unknown Southern governor in 1971 to the winning presidential candidate in 1976, narrowly defeating Republican Gerald Ford. Mediating the 1979 Camp David Accords and the eventual peace treaty between Egypt and Israel was the pinnacle of Carter's presidency.
There had been four wars between Arabs and Israelis in the previous 25 years, with the Egyptians in the leadership, supported by the Soviet Union. They were the only country that could really challenge Israel militarily.
Carter also negotiated a treaty returning control of the Panama Canal to Panama, and established full diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China. But the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran would change the course of his presidency. Protests led by Shiite clerics toppled the U.S.-backed Shah, who fled the country. Militants later stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 66 Americans hostage. In late November of that year, 13 hostages were released. In April 1980, Carter authorized a military operation to free the remaining hostages. It failed, and 8 U.S. service members died. Carter also faced challenges at home. Inflation and rising unemployment hobbled the economy, contributing to his 1980 election defeat to Republican Ronald Reagan. On January 20, 1981, Reagan's inauguration day, Iran finally freed the American hostages. Carter, defeated and depressed, returned to Plains to plan his presidential library.
I envisioned to be a tiny thing where I would have an office and some nice buildings in Atlanta.
It became much more. A well-known global nonprofit, the Carter Center has monitored over 100 elections and mediated disputes ranging from a nuclear standoff with North Korea in 1994 to a peace agreement between Uganda and Sudan. The center also promotes health and fights illness in the poorest parts of the planet. Eradicating guinea worm disease has been a primary goal.
There's only been one disease in the history of humankind ever eradicated, and that was smallpox more than 30 years ago. So guinea worm is going to soon be the second disease in history to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Carter's work helping humanity led to Oslo, Norway in 2002, where he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize.
When I won the Nobel Peace Prize, for instance, it was because of the work of the Carter Center. So I would be perfectly satisfied to have a legacy based on peace and human rights. I mean, who would?
Carter led an active life into his 90s, surviving brain cancer in 2015. But declining health and the 2020 global coronavirus pandemic kept him confined to his hometown of Plains in his final years. In one of his last public media appearances, Carter shared with VOA his hopes for the future.
I would like to see the United States in the future strive to be the number one champion in the world of peace and human rights and environmental equality. And I would say treating everybody equal. If we could do that, we'd have a real superpower in a country that I love very much.
Carter lived the longest of any occupant of the White House, and his 76-year marriage to wife Rosalynn is the longest of any president and first lady. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
After leaving Washington, Jimmy Carter founded the Carter Center, as you just heard, which has monitored elections in hotspots worldwide, including many in Africa. He strove to give people in the United States and elsewhere a better life. But the peanut farmer from Georgia faced many challenges when he served in the White House. I asked Wendy Schiller, professor of public and international affairs at Brown University in Rhode Island, about that.
Jimmy Carter, as president, tried to shift sort of the narrative about the United States from war. We had just come out of Vietnam and Watergate to human rights, to the principles of democracy, and using U.S. power, military and economic, to try to encourage democracy around the globe at a time when most countries that we know today to be democracies were in fact run by dictators or people who didn't respect the kind of principles that the United States professed to uphold. So Jimmy Carter tried, and you can argue that the world wasn't ready for it, and you can argue that he missed some really key signals about the kinds of disruptions that would happen when these dictators fell, like we saw with the fall of the Shah in Iran, and which set the stage for certainly our U.S. relationship with Iran today. So in that sense, you can say his mission was honorable, but his timing was bad.
He had a tough time in Washington, really. Once he got here, you know, there were the crazy gas prices, and then Ronald Reagan came along, and he did not get reelected. You know, Ronald Reagan won overwhelming a number of U.S. states when that election came around. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, he had a difficult time because he came as a governor. And we know that sometimes governors succeed in Washington. You can argue Ronald Reagan came in having been a governor and succeeded. But sometimes they find it difficult to deal with Congress. And Jimmy Carter had an overwhelmingly Democratic House and Senate, a huge majority. But the Democratic Party was shifting at that time from very Southern conservative dominated to a more urban and liberal dominated party. So it was very a fractious party that didn't always agree. So he was a Southerner, having won, but he had to make deals with all sorts of different constituencies in the Democratic Party, which should sound familiar to us. So that was transitional, and that was sort of, you know, very heavy sledding for him. But he laid the groundwork for things like credits for clean energy. I mean, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act environmental stuff couldn't have been passed by Joe Biden if Jimmy Carter hadn't passed a solar energy tax credit in his big energy bill in the 1970s.
Didn't he, in fact, create the Department of Energy?
Yeah, he did. And he also justified government subsidy or government tax breaks for developing alternative energies. And, of course, that meant that he was at loggerheads with a lot of Southern senators who were Democrats from coal-producing states. And notably this guy Robert Byrd from West Virginia, who was an important leader in the Democratic Party. So part of his difficulties with the Democrats in Washington at the time, his own party, was because he was trying to do things that were not in their local interest, and they really worked hard to block him.
Talk about his legacy a little after he left office and how he became such a revered statesman and what he did for countries, especially in Africa, when it comes to getting rid of guinea worm in several countries. He wanted to make sure of the monitoring of elections with the Carter Center, free and fair elections around the world. Talk a little more about those things.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Carter literally was a preacher. He practiced what he preached. And he basically did as a private citizen, as an ex-president, what he really wanted to do as president, which was spread what he thought was the best of America, its generosity, its charity, its healthcare expertise, its ability to sort of wipe out diseases, and also try to encourage and pressure world leaders into peace. And he had, relatively good success between Israel and Egypt, as we know, with the Camp David Accords. So he really lived what he spoke about, and he had enough, I think, authenticity to really put pressure on world leaders to come to the table. And I think that was the principle he upheld, Habitat for Humanity, certainly, showing that volunteer work, community work in your own community could better the lives of your neighbors. And these were principles, I think, that were infectious and spread in a good way across a lot of communities in the United States and around the world.
That's Wendy Schiller, professor at Brown University. VOA host of Africa News Tonight, Yehias Wuhib, spoke with President Carter several years ago about eradicating guinea worm disease. Here's an excerpt of that interview.
Hello, this is Jimmy Carter.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
My name is Yehias Wuhib, originally from Ethiopia.
Yes.
Right now I'm an international radio broadcaster here at The Voice of America.
It's good to talk to you.
It's an honor and a privilege talking to you, sir. Mr. President, Nigeria recently eliminated guinea worm disease, and at least 15 other countries have also rid themselves of the illness. If the disease is spread through water infected with larvae that are microscopic, how do you guarantee that it won't easily return? Meaning, does that country would have to have a modern water sanitation system or a constant testing process?
No, they can still drink water from the same rain pond as before. But what the village has to do is to make sure that nobody goes into the pond water waiting or to get another drink of water with guinea worm emerging from their bodies. So if the adult worms don't go into the water and lay new eggs, then a year later, if everybody does that, then a year later, you won't have any more guinea worm ever unless somebody comes there from outside and goes into the water with a guinea worm coming out. So it's a one-year cycle. It has to go through a human being, and if nobody goes into the water for a year with an adult guinea worm laying eggs, then the disease is gone from that pond forever.
What lessons learned from Nigeria could be applied to other countries?
Well, to get as much publicity as possible for the most remote areas of the country, and to recruit as much assistance as you can. This is the key to it. Quite often, the people in the remote villages they're illiterate. They can't read and write. So we use posters without words on it to tell the story about guinea worm. But you have to go to every single village individually. And we were lucky enough in Ethiopia to have very strong support from a former president, General Gowon, G-O-W-O-N. So we try to recruit as many partners as we can. And this was especially effective in Nigeria, where we started out with about 650,000 cases and went down to zero.
That is amazing.
That is former President Jimmy Carter speaking with my colleague, Yehias Wuhib. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam, filling in for James Buddy in Washington. Today is Monday, December 30th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Coming up, how Mozambique's political unrest has affected border trade. As Mozambique grapples with a political crisis following a disputed national election and violent protests, the situation at its southern border with South Africa has become increasingly volatile, affecting trade and travel. South Africa and neighboring Eswatini are collaborating to find a solution to the growing crisis along the border, with Managua Border Post serving as a lifeline for those seeking passage from Mozambique. Nokukhanya Musi reports from Eswatini's capital.
Escalating violence in Mozambique has forced trade and travel to be diverted from neighboring South Africa's Lebombo border post to Eswatini's Mananga border post. Michael Masiapato, commissioner of South Africa's Border Management Authority, told VOA that although authorities are managing the crisis, it continues to pose significant challenges.
The corridor from Rasen Garcia here, Lebombo Rasen Garcia to Maputo, is around 120 kilometers. So even on that basis, when they deploy the military and when they deploy police officers on the corridor, it is not able to cover each and every area. And I think you will fairly be aware of the nature of the protest that side. It is very much sporadic and it is very much widespread. The biggest challenge that we have on the Mozambican side is that The corridor has a lot of your townships around it, your Madola, as it were, and all of those towards the port.
Following presidential candidate Daniel Chapo's controversial election victory Monday, Mozambique has been plunged into turmoil, leaving scores dead amid violent protests. Some analysts have expressed concern that continued political violence could destabilize regional security and impede economic development, sparking weapons proliferation and criminal activity. Solomon Mondlane, a political analyst in Mozambique, told VOA he is cautiously optimistic that South African and European efforts can help defuse the situation.
The situation is volatile. The good news is we're hearing more calls from different countries, from South Africa, from other European countries, calling for more dialogue. South Africa has come out to say they're willing to facilitate a dialogue.
Levin Dore, a South African political analyst and lecturer at Tshwane University of Technology in Johannesburg, said he believes regional players' efforts at dialogue with the Mozambican government are encouraging signs that many in the region are seeking peace and stability.
Already there are efforts to deal with the crisis in Mozambique. Minister Ronald Lamola of the Republic of South Africa has already started with the initiatives of having discussions with the government of Mozambique. And those are the efforts that appears to be supported by many people who want to see peace and stability.
Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is chairing the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, has said the regional bloc is ready to assist Mozambique engulfed in post-election violence that has claimed more than 100 protesters' lives. Nokukhanya Musi, VOA News, Mbabane, Eswatini.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Amali in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Carol. We begin the sports with results of matches played in the second leg of the 2024 CAF African Nations Championship CHAN. 18 teams have now confirmed their places in the finals set for East African countries of Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda. The Central African Republic achieved a historic first qualification by eliminating 2021 semi-finalist Cameroon in a stunning 2-1 comeback in Bafoussam. In Uyo, Nigeria's home-based Super Eagles secured a 3-1 win over arch-rivals Ghana to book their place. Elsewhere in Bamako, Burkina Faso overturned a 2-goal deficit from the first leg against Cote d'Ivoire, forcing penalties. The Stallions held their nerve, converting 4 spot kicks to the Elephants 2, securing their spot at the CHAN 2024. For their part, DR Congo continued their dominance at home with a 3-1 victory over Chad in Kinshasa to also clinch their spot at the tournament in February. Guinea confirmed their superiority over Guinea-Bissau with a 2-1 away win, completing a 6-2 aggregate triumph. Meanwhile, Senegal defeated Liberia 3-0 to also secure their place thanks to goals by Omar Ba, Baye Cisse and Madaye Mbaye to secure their ticket to the tournament meant for players playing on the African continent and in their local leagues. In motorsports, the African Rally Championship and World Rally Championship will run concurrently in 2025. In addition, the World Rally Championship Safari Rally aims to expand its motorsport culture across East Africa by providing a high-profile event that will increase the enthusiasm and participation at all levels of the sport, event director Norris Ongalo.
In 2025, the proposal is to run WRC and ARC together. So this would be a very good platform for any driver who wants to run ARC and enjoy the fruits of having participated in a WRC.
And that does it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Carol, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that is it for this Monday, December 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, wishing you a great rest of your week. We'll see you again tomorrow morning.